The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Oh, it is. Hold on. What is today? It's Wednesday. And I'm still slightly, I'm kind of under the weather because I cracked a couple of ribs this weekend. And yeah, so this week I'm trying to take it a bit easy. So today, you know, in conjunction with that, we do have an important show for you. I live in Florida. We have the worst governor in the country, unequivocally. And what makes matters worse is this guy, moron death sentence, or Ron DeSantis, you know, or even DeSantis, whatever you want to call him. He is pure evil. And I promise you, he's worse than Trump. So we do need to get rid of him. We have two candidates vying for the Democratic nomination to take him on. Charlie Crist, former Republican governor of Florida, who's now a Democrat in the Congress, who is running, making his third run for the governor's office. And Nikki Fried, who is the only Democrat in Florida's executive suite, as it were. She is the Agriculture and Consumer Affairs Commissioner. Now, I've had both of them on the show. They were both here shortly after they announced their candidacy back in September. So I thought what we do is listen back to those two interviews back to back. It's sort of a getting to know you kind of thing. Yeah. And then, you know, it's one to help my fellow Floridians make their choice. It is primary season. August 23rd is our primary, but mail-in ballots are already going out. And early voting starts soon, so I figure this is a good opportunity, a getting to know you kind of thing. So, with no further ado, we'll start. Now, when they were first on, Nikki Fried was here first. She was on, I believe, September 20th. Charlie Crist was on September 28th. So today we'll reverse the order. We will begin with Charlie Crist. You ready? Take it away. Here we go. I'm pleased to welcome the man who was the 44th governor of Florida, right? 44th, wasn't it?
That's
Governor
right.
Crist. And now a congressman representing Florida's 13th congressional district, who's running for governor again. Congressman, governor, what do I call you?
Charlie.
Just call me Charlie. Okay, Charlie. Well, welcome to the show. You don't remember, though we have met before, when I first moved back to Florida back in 2004. I believe you were attorney general and running for governor at the time, and then you became governor. At the time, I worked for a little while at WFTL and then with Jim DeFede over at WINZ when South Florida still had a progressive talk station.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful.
Right. And then, so it's been a while. I've watched.
We got some history. That's a good thing.
We do have some history. So I was not born here. I was born in New York, but my family moved down here when I was 11. So I went to, you know, middle school, high school, and college, all in Florida. Graduated from USF in your neck of the woods.
Yes.
And so, you know, I'm pretty dug into Florida politics as much as one can be. And so we've watched the changes. Now, it's funny. When I used to work with Jim DeFede, he called you, and he didn't mean this in any bad way, but the best Democratic governor that Florida's had in a while. And of course, you were a Republican at the time.
You know, I got to tell you the truth, Nicole. I've had many friends say to me when I was still a Republican, Charlie, you're a Democrat. You just don't know it. And, now I know it. And I'm very happy being a Florida Democrat. Really am.
Well, but let's start with that. You were a Republican. You worked your way up. I think you were Secretary of Education, then became Attorney General, then became Governor, now a member of Congress. Through your governor term, you were a Republican. Why were you a Republican? What was it about the Republican Party that made you identify with them?
You know, I was a Republican because mom and dad were. It's the same reason I'm a Methodist, because mom and dad are. And, you know, that's the way it was for a while. And then, you know, when I got elected governor, that was 2006. And toward the end of that term, 2009, 2010, was the rise of the Tea Party in the Republican Party, started moving harder and harder to the right. And I developed a good working relationship with then President Barack Obama, obviously a Democrat. And I was still a Republican at the time. And I can remember him wanting to come to Florida, Nicole. It's a short story, I promise.
Oh, it's okay.
He was coming to Fort Myers in like February of 2009, in the middle of the Great Recession. And so we get a call in my office in Tallahassee inviting me to go to be with the president. And so some staff members came into my office. They shared that information with me. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And then they said to me, Governor, are you sure? And I said, yeah, why do you ask? They said, well, you know, he's a Democrat. I said, he's the president of the United States of America. He's coming here to help Florida and our country get out of this economic tailspin that we're in. And please let the White House know that I will be there. And so I go, and we're at the Fort Myers Convention Center downtown, right on the river. And I'm downstairs in the area where his car drove in, like a garage type area, the big black Cadillac, right? He's in the back seat. He motions to me when the car stops to come back to him. So I do. He opens the door. He moves over to the other side of the back of the car and says, please have a seat for a minute, Charlie. I want to, you know, tell you a few things. And I said, okay. And he says, you know, a couple of things. Number one, thank you for being here today. I really appreciate it. And I said, I'm honored to be here. He goes, you are going to take a lot of grief for having been here today. I said, well, I don't know about that. He goes, trust me, you will. But he said, since you are here, he said, would you mind introducing me today? And I said, no, that would be an honor as well. I'd be more than happy to do it. So I said, well, you know, we'll go in there. It's going to be loud. Be ready. These are my people. Go up to the podium. Just say whatever is on your heart and your mind about me, about the Recovery Act, the stimulus, as it's known as. I'll come up and I'll say my thing and that'll be it. Is that all right? I said, you're the commander in chief. That's fine. So I go up to the podium and I gave what I thought was a proper introduction for our president and concluded by saying, please give a warm Florida welcome to President Barack Obama. He comes up to the lectern. He shakes my hand.
Yes.
Then he hugs me.
Yeah. And in fact, here's the picture. There's,
you know, well, you have the photo.
There's the hug.
That is the hug. And, you know, like I say, somebody took a picture of it. And that was kind of it for me as a Republican office holder. And I'll tell you something I think is pretty interesting. I don't think it was just because I was willing to work with a Democratic president. I was also working with the first Black president.
Oh, yes.
And it saddens me to say that. And I don't want to paint too broad a brush here, Nicole. I mean, there's a lot of good Republicans, so believe me. But there is that element within the party, and it broke my heart. And that's when I decided I'm out of here. This is not how I was raised. My mom and dad raised me and my three sisters to respect all people, regardless of where they're from or what they look like or what their background is. And so that kind of was the beginning of becoming then an independent. And then ultimately a Democrat.
Well, that photograph, I pulled it for good reason, because that is the moment that those political watchers said that's the moment that your career as a Republican politician ended, because you embraced the first Black Democratic president and you were Republican.
Exactly.
And when you look at the difference between the Republican Party of 2008, 2009 and today, is there any similarity? Do you see any common ground there?
No, very little, Nicole. In fact, the way I express it is I think the party since then has metastasized and it's just gotten worse. I mean, look at it under Donald Trump and what we experienced the last 4 years of his presidency, frankly, and where it is now, where the big lie is something that people in the party have to tout, at least if they're office holders, and they have to say that this is what reality is when it clearly is not. I mean, it's sad. It really is sad.
Now, when you were governor, I got to say, although, you know, you were a Republican, I wasn't your biggest supporter. You did something. You stood up for the teachers. And that
won a lot of people over. I know my sister's a teacher, and she's like, I have to vote for him. He stood up for us. So when you see what Rick DeSantis is doing, or Ron DeSantis is doing now with, you know, docking the pays of administrators who might try to enforce a mask mandate, try to protect our kids. And now, I mean, it just goes on and on.
It's appalling. It's appalling. And it's beyond the pale. I can't even believe we're watching this and experiencing it. And what else that I think is weird about it, I mean, this is a fellow who went to Harvard and Yale. And so you would assume, you know, would have a certain level of intellect.
You would think.
And yet, you know, these policies of not listening to science, not listening to physicians, not adhering to what healthcare professionals are telling us is the right thing to do in order to keep our children safe in school and our teachers safe in the same classroom. It's remarkable to me. And the only way I can explain it, and I'm not even sure it does, is that I think he's so laser focused on trying to get the Republican nomination for president 2024 that he's completely forgotten about Florida. He is playing and pandering to one base, and it's the hard right conservative wacko base, if you will, of today's Republican Party. And it defies logic. It doesn't make sense. And it's killing people in our state. And I'll give you one example, not a death, but a bad situation, and it's personal. So I live in St. Petersburg, near where USF is, as you know. And my niece goes to school. She's 5 years old. She's in elementary school. They started a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And in Pinellas County, there's no mask mandate. So what happens? She gets COVID.
Then
she brings it home.
Oh, God.
She's 5 years old, right? So her younger sister, my 2-month-old niece, gets COVID this last week. I mean, that's what's happening all over Florida because of bad leadership, because of leadership by the governor that is not listening to science. And, you know, my dad's a physician. You talked about your sister being a teacher. I stood up for teachers. 2 of my 3 sisters were public school teachers. So I'm a public school kid. You know, I went to St. Petersburg High School. I went to elementary school. They're all public school the whole way through and graduated Florida State University. So, you know, that's where my heart is. That's where my passion is. And I want to fight for teachers. And of course, I always will. And I want to fight for the environment and things that are being neglected. Women's rights. My God, they're under assault now, too. Voters' rights, civil rights. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's unbelievable.
Right. Well, we've got a lot of problems here in Florida. So, Charlie, let's talk about some of them. You mentioned women's rights. Let's just start there, because under DeSantis, they've introduced legislation in Florida. I don't know how, because they're not in session now, but they've introduced a bill to basically do the same thing that they did in Texas, a heartbeat bill, which is a misnomer because it's not a heartbeat. It's six weeks. It's a electrical impulse or something. But Florida? Really?
I know. It's horrible. It's horrible. And you know, I told you I was raised with 3 sisters. And so my respect for women was in my DNA as a kid. And, you know, the notion that these men in Tallahassee are going to tell women what to do with their body is appalling to me. You know, we're all children of God. And I think that we all deserve mutual respect, literal respect. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that a woman should be able to make her own decision about her own body at any time. You know, maybe consulting with her physician or her family, what have you, but not her government. And the DeSantis is going after that now. He went after voters' rights earlier, signing a bill last spring that said it's going to be harder to do mail-in ballots than it was before. Shoot, my 89-year-old father, my 86-year-old mother, love to utilize mail-in ballots. It's
convenient. I use mail-in ballots.
I love it, too. It's great. And particularly during a pandemic, it was smart that we had that. Now they're going to make it harder. And the irony is that the governor said after the last election last November, what a great election it was. And so then they go to work in the legislative session trying to fix a problem we don't even have.
Exactly.
Why? To suppress the vote. to make it harder for Democrats to get out and vote. Not only the mail-in ballot, but making it more difficult, but drop boxes in minority communities throughout the state of Florida. I mean, it's discrimination. It's appalling what they're doing, and I hope that that will get thrown out in court.
Right, and I think I remember, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this is a memory that is something good that you did. I think you extended early voting hours, if I'm not mistaken, in Florida to accommodate people who wanted to vote. That's something that the Republican Party just does not do. They err on the side of not letting you vote, trying to keep people from voting because, oh my God, somebody who's not supposed to vote might get through. Of course, I don't believe that's their real reason, but to suppress the vote.
You
extended voting hours.
No question. I did. And you know, it's an interesting short story. Again, that was 2008, Barack Obama's first election.
Right.
So he's running against John McCain. Mm-hmm. And the close of the election with early voting going on, huge lines across the state of Florida, people trying to vote, a lot of them seniors. And, you know, it's Florida. So in late October, it's still hot.
Oh, yeah.
And so I get a call from Dan Gelber, now mayor of Miami Beach.
Yeah.
Who was then a state senator.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls me up and he says, Governor, you know, you got to do something about this. I'm sure you can watch in Tallahassee on the news and see these long lines we're suffering from in South Florida. These people need to be able to vote. And I said, well, Dan, what do you think I can do? He goes, you could sign an executive order, if you're willing, to extend the hours of early voting. And I said, I don't know, do I have the authority to do that? And I asked my general counsel, I said, do I have the authority to do that as governor unilaterally? And the general counsel to the governor told me, I don't think you do, because it has to be an emergency situation to sign an executive order like that. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer too. In fact, I used to be attorney general. Let's talk about this for a minute. We're talking about people not being able to vote in a democracy in a presidential election.
That's an emergency.
Vote, right. That sounds like, thank you, an emergency. So I said, please go draft it. I'm going to sign it. And within hours after that, we had longer hours for people to be able to vote in Florida. Yeah, I mean, welcome people to vote. Encourage democracy. They're trying to suppress democracy and hurt the vote. And that's just wrong.
Do you still talk to some of your old Republican allies and coworkers and colleagues? And how do they feel about the change in that party?
Not good. I mean, you know, listen, there are moderate Republicans that are alive and well. And, you know, those people I still keep in communication with, and they're frustrated by what they see. They're frustrated by this governor in particular, and sort of the iron fist with which he is ruling our state. I mean, telling local governments that they can't issue mask mandates. You know, it used to be in the Republican Party that they would say the government closest to the people governs best. Well, he's doing exactly the opposite. Right. Thing. But he's following the model of Donald Trump. He's like mini-me.
Right.
Trump.
But that's the thing. Okay, so that's Ron DeSantis, and he's God awful. I mean, we can all agree on that. My nickname for him is Moron Death Sentence because, well, it's...
Well, I got another one for you. If you haven't heard this yet, I call him Wrong DeSantis.
Oh, Wrong DeSantis. That's good.
W in front of the R.
Yep.
And a G after the N in Ron,
right.
And it's Wrong DeSantis because he's wrong on women's choice. He's wrong on civil rights. He's wrong on voters' rights. He's wrong on education. And he's certainly dead wrong on COVID.
Right. Well, that works. But I want to go back a little further. Now, sure. You were governor. Your term ended in 2010, right?
Right.
And you, that's when you decided you were going to run for the Senate.
Right.
And we wound up with Rick Scott as governor. Yeah. Now, as bad as Ron DeSantis is, Rick Scott, Voldemort was my nickname for him. And because it fits, it just, you know, physically it works. Yeah. Do you regret that now, not staying in the governor's office, which probably would have been a safe bet for re-election, I would think, unless the Obama hug was so detrimental.
I'm asked that a fair amount. And no, I don't regret it because the rationale behind doing it for me was pretty simple. As we stated earlier, talked about, that was right when the Great Recession was hitting Florida and the country. And most of the money that was coming to the rescue to help us, I referenced the Recovery Act.
Yep.
That was $12 billion to Florida. That came from the federal government. That came from the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. And I knew that if we're going to get more help, that's where it was going to have to come from, because that's where they print the money, not in Tallahassee, in Washington. So, no, I don't regret trying to do that. I wanted to do it to help my Florida.
But then we wound up with Rick Scott, who blew my mind that he was elected, but the most unsympathetic, unattractive character. I'm not talking physical here. I'm talking about everything about him, his persona, everything was just so standoffish. And why the people voted for him, I don't understand. And then we got Marco Rubio in the Senate. We got hit from both sides, a double whammy, and it to the detriment of this state over the last decade. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. That certainly is a fact. And now we have Ron DeSantis. And so I think hard as I thought this would be, it's even gotten worse. You know, he is worse. There's no question. And that's why I'm running for governor, because it breaks my heart to see what's happened to our Florida. I know Florida's people are good, decent, hardworking people, like the many teachers that we talked about earlier, firefighters, law enforcement officers. You know, there's a lot of good people in the Sunshine State, and they deserve better. And that's why I'm running for governor, to give them a choice, to give them an option, because what we have now is he doesn't have their back.
Right.
He doesn't have my 2-month-old niece's back, let alone, you know, people that work for the state. And they're not being informed about people in those agencies that might be testing positive for
COVID. Or kids that go to school. There's no, he made it so that if a kid is exposed, they don't even have to tell that child's parents that your child was exposed to COVID, to give them the chance to pull the kid out of school or whatever. It's just, it's reprehensible.
It's unbelievable.
So let's talk about healthcare for a moment, though.
Sure,
because,
sure.
Okay, so obviously, Rick Scott was in office during the whole Obamacare fight, and when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it became law, turned down the Medicaid expansion, did not participate. You know, thankfully, we do have, it's the only reason I'm alive, is access to the Affordable Care Act, because I'm a lung cancer survivor, and as an independent radio host, I was unable to buy insurance on the open market. So there's that.
God bless you for that, yes.
So, you know, it's far from perfect. I would like to see Medicare for All. I'm curious as to where you are on Medicare for All or some kind of a public option going forward.
I support a public option, much in the same way President Biden does. And I think it's important to give more healthcare coverage to more people. No question in my mind. And we're the richest country in the world, Nicole.
I know.
Not only that, we're the richest country in the history of
the world. Yep.
So if we can't give healthcare to more folks, I don't know who can. We can, and we should. And now you touched on Medicaid expansion.
Yes.
It's unconscionable to me that 800,000 to 1 million of our fellow Floridians aren't going to have health care again tomorrow because wrong DeSantis says no. He's wrong on that, too. And I remember opening up one of my campaign offices in Miami-Dade County in a prior campaign and election. And there was a young man there. There was a big turnout. This is all pre-COVID, of course. Nice turnout there. And a young man in a wheelchair was there, probably in his early 30s. And so I'm drawn to people, and I was drawn to him, got on my knee because I didn't want him to have to look up like little kids do if you don't kind of get down and get level with them. And I asked him, I said, "Now, I noticed you're here. I'm honored that you came, but I'm curious, why are you here today for our campaign office opening here in Miami-Dade?" And he said, "One reason. I know you believe in expanding Medicaid, and I don't have health care.
Oh, God.
And if you win, I will get Medicaid." It's that important to people. And sometimes people who don't have empathy or compassion don't have that chip. They just don't get it. But I do have that chip, and in abundance, I hope, and I believe I do. I care about people, and I want them to have good lives and a good quality of life and good health care during their life and not have it be so expensive that they go bankrupt or whatever. This is what we need in a leader, in my humble opinion. We need somebody who truly cares about people, men, women, children, black, white, gay, straight, you know, short, tall. You know, we're all, as I said earlier, children of God, and we deserve to have good lives and people who are in positions of authority that give a damn about us.
I want to ask about marijuana. We live in the Sunshine State. Cannabis, you know, there's a reason it's called weed, because it grows like weeds. We could grow it here. We could fill our coffers. It could be great for the economy. Now, I know that you worked for John Morgan when you were in between elected gigs. John Morgan was the attorney who basically spearheaded the medical marijuana campaign to get it legal here in Florida. Sunk a lot of time and money into it. Where are you on the issue of recreational marijuana?
Oh, I think we should legalize it. We should have done it yesterday. And then we'd be able to tax it, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. Talk about a revenue source for it. It would be incredible. We could use it to help pay our teachers more and not just give them bonus checks that bounce. I mean, you know, you can't make up this stuff, but that's what's going on. Plus, it's personal. I mentioned to you, I had three sisters. I have two now. My older sister passed. She got a brain tumor died from it. And I had to watch her have to deal with pain from that experience without having even medical marijuana at the time. And so it seems to me it's just the right thing to do. Frankly, I think it's probably a lot less harmful than alcohol.
Oh, yeah. I fully agree. I'm not a drinker, but I smoke.
What it would do to help us in terms of the revenue addition to Florida, that could help us, as I said, with education and, you know, firefighters, you know, helping people that work in.
Oh, and every and every front, you know, environmental issues. We've got the Everglades that, you know, are in trouble. We know that Rick Scott, I'm going to wanted to drill in the Everglades. I hope that's a dead deal. Offshore, they're talking about, again, offshore drilling off the coast of Florida. There are all these kind of things. Where are you on protecting the pristine environment here?
I think I've been a huge champion for it. I know I have. In fact, I held the first climate change summit in the history of Florida as governor.
Right.
Did it with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right.
And
I remember
others.
That.
And it was the right thing to do because, you know, focusing, you know, we are a state that is so susceptible to climate change. Probably the most susceptible to rising sea levels since we're almost an island being a peninsula. And so I think it's vitally important. And Nicole, as I've always felt, I think that the environment and the economy in our state are inextricably linked together because our largest industry is tourism. Why? Because people like to come to Florida. Why do they want to do that? Because she's beautiful. And so we have a duty in order to protect our economy, to protect our environment, because they do go hand in hand. And so I'm passionate about it. I wasn't born in Florida either. I was born in Pennsylvania, but my family moved to St. Pete when I was 3 years old.
Wow.
And I love this state. I love our people. And we've got to look out for our environment for their benefit and generations after us.
We do. And you know, I feel bad. In recent years, I've taken to calling it Florida, because that's what we've become. This is a state that the rest of the country and the world, frankly, jokes about. Florida man, the stupidity. And I always tell people it's the humidity, not the heat. But seriously, I think it's it comes from the top down. In this case, we've had now we're going on 12 years. We had Rick Scott for 8 and now Ron DeSantis. It's like, oh, my God, please, a return to normalcy.
Sanity.
Right. Sanity.
Well, we can do it. We can do it. And you know, I'll give you an analogy. And people have suggested this to me, that my race may be similar to Joe Biden's race against Donald Trump. In Biden, we had a very seasoned, very experienced, very steady hand, somebody that people knew and had trust and confidence in. In his opponent, President Trump at the time, we had a rookie president, and he acted like it every single day.
Embarrassing.
In this race, if I get the nomination, experienced, done the job itself before, been attorney general of the state, commissioner of education for our public school system, and a state senator. On the other hand, we've got Ron DeSantis, a rookie governor who acts like it or worse every single day.
Right. And he's emulating Trump, which is the worst thing possible. He's mean. He's a bully. He's nasty to everybody who doesn't agree with him. And now I heard that he's talking about if you're a Florida state government employee and you criticize him, that you need to watch out because you'll either be fired or, I don't know, worse.
I know. It's unbelievable.
To that.
I mean, he's a bully.
He's a bully.
That's all it is.
And it's wrong. Charlie Crist, I need to go here just because you're here, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. Obviously, over the years, your ideas and positions change. That's normal. Everybody goes through changes. Your website, which is charliecrist.com, does not have your positions on different issues. This is a problem I have with a lot of candidates. And what I've noticed is the real progressive ones Put it all out there. You can go to their website and you can see where they are on education, on healthcare, on taxes, on infrastructure, you name it, it's there. It's not on your website, but it's not on Nikki Fried's either. Why don't you put it out there? Why isn't
it on there? That's a great criticism, and I appreciate it very much, and I'll fix it.
Okay. Here's the delicate part.
Sure.
On LGBTQ issues. Over the years, your position has varied, I will say that. Back in the day when you were governor, you were against, I believe, same-sex marriage. You were certainly against gay couples adopting. You were just not good on issues for the LGBTQ community. In conjunction with that are the rumors. Now, it's what anybody does in the privacy of their home or with their personal relationships is their own business. The knock on you has been that there are these rumors floating around, have been for better part of a decade or more, that you're a closeted gay man, and that's not the issue. The issue has been your that not being good on issues for the gay community.
Well, I'm not, number one, which is fine. But what it's important, I think, is I've evolved on the issue the same way President Obama has. Hmm. And I can remember him saying that, you know, he was supportive of gay couples not being able to be married, but to cohabitate, to be together. And then he came around during his presidency, right after Vice President Biden at the time. I think he sort of jumped the gun.
Yes, he did.
But I remember the president was so eloquent in this interview with a British journalist, if I recall correctly. And he said, I have come to the view, this is President Obama, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that, you know, who am I to judge? And who am I to tell other people who to love? And so for that reason, he said, I do support gay marriage, and I will from now going forward. And I feel the same way and did it at about the same time. So, you know, people grow up, they get wiser. They have greater compassion and greater understanding. And, you know, there's somebody that is to judge. It's not me. It's not you. It's somebody else. And I think the right thing to do is to honor all people. As I said earlier, doesn't matter if they're gay or straight, black or white, short
I agree.
Or tall.
Or believer or atheist.
That's right.
Let me throw that out there because you made a few references to God, and I'm actually one of those people who's not. I'm not. I don't have organized religion in my life, and I believe in the power of the universe, but I don't believe in a God. So, you know, these are the things. I think that there needs to be greater separation between church and state. And so your references to God all the time, I love that that's your, you know, belief and your conviction, but just know that not everybody in Florida has those beliefs.
Which is very fair, and you are right.
Charlie Crist, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'm impressed. You've answered every question I've asked you and thrown at you, and I wish you the best. So what happened?
Sorry.
One more question. Annette Tadeo, who was your running mate back when the last time you ran for governor, I've heard through the grapevine that she's getting ready to throw her hat in the ring as well. Have you heard that?
I've heard the speculation, and let me say this, anybody who wants to run should. It's a free country, you know, yet still
right now.
So anybody who wants to do that should do that. We need more good leaders now more than ever.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I'm sorry, I cut you off. I just wanted to get that out there about Annette Tadeo.
I think what you were saying was perfect. You know, I've enjoyed interviewing with you, and I was just going to tell you, I'm never going to shy away from answering questions. I think it's so important. If you're asking the people to put their trust in you and to give you their vote, which is precious, as John Lewis, my former colleague, used to always tell us, then the least you can do is be transparent and be honest and be forthright. And I always strive to do that. I'm not perfect, but, you know, you got to do the best that you can. And I know for the future of Florida, we need somebody who is a decent person, who cares about people, who will shoot you straight and tell you the truth.
That should be
and
the bottom line.
Strive to do that.
If you don't mind, because you're still a sitting congressman, let me ask you with what's going on there right now, the fights between, there was a deal cut, as far as I understood, between between the leaders.
Princes and the moderates, basically, I think is what you're alluding
yes,
to.
Yes, and right, the, with the BIF, or the hard infrastructure bill, and the larger, you know, Build Back Better bill. They need better names for these things.
Right.
And the progressives right now, there's a bit of a standoff. Nancy Pelosi today backed off on the deal that they made and said, we're going to not do one without the other. They're married. They're joined together. Today she said, well, we're going to go forward and have a vote on the BIF on Thursday and let the chips fall where they may, as far as I can tell. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you must be clairvoyant. I was just asked this question on CNN about 45 minutes ago. Well, how I feel about it, I think we need to do both. I don't care if they're together or separate. I just know that both of them need to be done. We need the, you know, the hard infrastructure bill, for lack of a better term, if you will, for roads, for bridges, for ports, and the things that we all know it throughout America, certainly in Florida, need to be improved. Maybe get us a little high-speed rail, which we almost had before. But we also need the $3.5 trillion as well, in my view. You know, and as it relates to Florida, where that could be enormously helpful is something you mentioned earlier, Everglades restoration. We could get $5 billion for Everglades restoration if we get that $3.5 trillion. So both of these are important to the Sunshine State. Both are important to America. I don't care if they're wedded, if they're apart, as long as both pass, because that's what the country needs.
And so you're on the record, no matter what order they come in, when you're a yes vote on both of them.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. The country needs it.
We do.
We're still in the middle of this pandemic. People are still hurting. Some people don't have the empathy to realize it, but it is happening and it's real. And so, yeah, I'm willing to invest in America anytime, any day, anywhere.
Awesome. Charlie Crist, thank you so much. I hope we can do this again. I really appreciate your time and
your
answers.
You're great, man. Oh. You're wonderful. You do a great job. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You take
care. Universe bless you. Let me do it that way.
Thank you so much. You too. There he said, see, universe bless you, because I called him out on the God thing. So there you go. Charlie Crist, that was recorded back in September 28th, 2021. Now we're going to go back to September 20th. So it was the week before when I got to speak with Nikki Fried. Oh, by the way, we mentioned Annette Tadeo. She did get into the race, and then she got out of the race. She's now running for Congress from the 27th district, and she'll be on with me tomorrow, believe it or not. Not an old interview, but a new one. Okay? All right. So, ready to hear from Nikki Fried? Through the magic of the power of videotape, we go back to September of last year. And Nikki Fried, here we go. Whoops.
Nikki Fried, a lot of people who are listening maybe don't know you. You are the Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services here in Florida. That's sort of a weird combination, is it? Agriculture and consumer services, why do they go together?
Yeah, so there's like some history on this. So the Ag Commissioner is in our Constitution. And when they had over time kind of changed the makeup of the cabinet, they got rid of some positions. And so over time, they kept trying to figure out, well, who was going to be responsible for this activity or who's responsible for that one. And at the time, there was an Ag Commissioner who kept just raising his hand and said, we'll take it over here. And so they expanded this position to not just be agriculture, but agriculture consumer services. The other aspect of it is there were some times when there was a threat to taking it out of the Constitution. And so the ag community felt, well, maybe if we just create such a big position with so many responsibilities, that will help us keep the Commissioner of Agriculture as a constitutional officer.
Did you have any involvement with the world of agriculture before taking on this position?
Well, I came from the marijuana space. So that's kind of where my ag background comes from is I was very involved in the medical marijuana program here in the state of Florida. Also one of the lead just government consultants across the country on this issue. So I do fundamentally believe that the future of agriculture is the cannabis plant. And so feeling that that's kind of where the synergy had come from when I decided to run for ag commissioner.
You know, I love hearing that. I'm astounded. Look, we live in the Sunshine State. Things grow here like weeds. Go figure. Weeds. The fact that we're not growing it and taxing it and making a fortune and filling our coffers is frankly astounding to me. But, you know, you won't appreciate it. But as I refer to the state, it's Florida. I want to get the duh out of Florida. So yep. This sounds like a no-brainer to me. But hey, we were on the road to getting close to having recreational marijuana on the ballot coming up. And then all of a sudden, we're not. What happened with that?
It's unfortunate. The Supreme Court kicked the ballot initiative, two of them, actually. There was two ballot initiatives that were being worked on. One that basically regulated it no different than they do alcohol. So basically, like you see the alcohol stores and licensing underneath that. The other one was a more restricted program, but still allowing for access and for legalization. The Supreme Court kicked both of those initiatives out. Obviously, I do not agree with that ruling by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, just a little concerned about some of the rulings coming out of the Supreme Court. There is another initiative, though, that just popped last week that is really more towards legalizing home grow and allowing each person in a household to have 9 plants to grow at home.
Yes.
And if there's 2 adults, then it's 18 plants that are allowed in the household, and also allowing for possession. So basically completely decriminalizing possession charges. So that's right out there. So definitely everybody look for your mailboxes. I think that they're going to be mailing them out. And so if not, you can certainly go online and find it and sign the petition and hope that the Supreme Court won't kick this one off the ballot as well.
That would be great. So, but marijuana is not the only issue facing us here in Florida. I think it's a big one. And I'm glad to know you're on the right side. Though I got to say, you released your financial disclosure forms just a couple of weeks ago. The media made a big deal out of it. It was a month or two late. And it does show you have a big stake in one of the big medical marijuana firms. Is that a conflict of interest at all?
Not at all. First of all, it's a very, very small. Okay. These companies are really large. Yes. I have 604 shares of a publicly traded company. And so, first of all, I do not regulate medical marijuana. So we can always start there, that I have no regulatory oversight that's underneath Department of Health. So there is no conflict of interest. Nothing that I could do inside the Department of Agriculture would have any impact on the stocks of these companies. And two, what I've said very publicly, that if given the opportunity to be the next governor of the state of Florida, where I would regulate, I would be selling my shares way beforehand. So okay. There would be no conflict. Even though part of what we do as elected officials, we have to disclose this information, but there's nothing in ethics laws or anything of that nature that says we can't own, you know, stocks. I mean, look at Rick Scott. I mean, how much,
God.
You know, he ran, you know, look at his portfolio. He had stocks in everything that he oversaw. So even if that was the case, we would create such a buffer between myself and any involvement with the cannabis space that there would be no inherent conflict. But just to even deal with taking it out of anybody's conversations, I would sell my shares way before I became actually installed as governor.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. Let's talk about some of the other things. Now, before you just got this position, you were elected in 2018. But that was the first time you had ever run for office, yes?
Yes.
And so what were you doing before then?
I'm a practicing attorney. So I've been practicing law for about 15 years, everywhere from South Florida to Central Florida to North Florida, everything from a big silk stocking law firm, which was atrocious, did that for a year. Great people, but that was not why I went to law school. I went to law school to give back and to do good. Then went to the public defender's office, where I was in Alachua County for 3.5 years, and then eventually made my way back to South Florida. And then prior to actually running, I was doing government consulting. I was representing Broward School Board, which I'm doing again today. So I never left that hat, different type of representing them, but fighting with them along the way. Fighting for our foster care children, represent an organization that is the voice of our foster care kids in Tallahassee and the medical marijuana space. So that was what I was doing before I ran in 2018 and took that courageous move to give my private life away and to give my life over to public service. And don't regret a single minute of it.
So you want to make the jump from attorney to agriculture commissioner to governor. What makes you qualified to be governor of the state of Florida?
Well, first of all, being again a Floridian my entire life, being a diehard, I've been an activist for issues my entire life. I was fighting for gay pride back in high school and doing Habitat for Humanity and soup kitchens. And so I am passionate about what it is that we need to be doing here in the state. Now, as commissioner, I have been in the executive position and running an agency of 4,600, have $1.3 billion. Budget. So as far as my executive experience, I'm a small business owner, so I have also real life experience. And you know what, to be governor, you know what you need to know, the qualifying aspect of being governor?
What?
You have to care. You have to care for the people that you govern.
Yeah.
That should be our number one qualifier for governor, is do you actually care about the people that you are planning on serving?
I guess that should bring us to talking about the guy currently holding the office, Ron DeSantis. Now, I have fun with his name all the time, but let's get serious here. Actually, when he was running 4 years ago, he was not the favorite. The favorite on the Republican side was Adam Putnam, who I believe, wasn't he the ag commissioner?
He was.
Yeah. And he had been groomed to move up and be governor until, of course, Donald Trump comes in, starts talking about this backbencher congressman, Ron DeSantis, and endorsed him. And all of a sudden he shoots up and Adam Putnam is never to be heard from again. I'm not saying whether Adam Putnam would have been, I think anyone would have been better than Ron DeSantis. But this is historically one of the routes taken up through the channels to on the way to governor. Charlie Crist, who's the other Democrat running in the race, actually was governor. And on his way to becoming governor, he was attorney general of the state of Florida. Then when he was elected, he was a Republican. I remember those days back. I was working with Jim DeFede then. And then I guess he decided he wanted to go to the Senate, which was a mistake on his part. I guess, Charlie Crist always is looking for the next job. And so and he wound up getting just pilloried, I think, due to the Tea Party movement. So he became an independent, and then eventually he became a Democrat. And now he's running for governor again, this time as a Democrat. Why are you better suited for this job than Charlie Crist?
My tagline for my campaign is something new. And that's what we in the state of Florida need. This is what the Democratic Party wants. They want a fresh face, fresh perspective, somebody who's a winner, somebody who is the only one who has won statewide as a Democrat in this race. And the people want to win. And the other thing that makes me qualified and why I will be the Democratic nominee is I've been a Democrat my entire life. What you are hearing today and people are seeing, I'm the same person that I was back in high school and middle school and elementary school. The same issues that I have been fighting for my entire life are the same issues that I stand up for today, whether it is abortion rights, whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's medical marijuana and marijuana legalization, whether it's fighting food insecurity and affordable housing. These are issues that I have been in the trenches on, not just policy points that I decided to talk about because I'm running for office. This is why I decided to run, because these are things that have been part of who I am. And in the Jewish faith, which is what I am, we call it tikkun olam, to heal the world. And that is part ingrained in my soul. Everything I do, I wake up every day and say, how can I make the world a better place? And that's why, when people are making a decision on the Democratic primary, they're going to want somebody who is honest. They're going to want somebody who is dedicated to their convictions, somebody who is a fighter, a fierce fighter. I don't turn down challenges. I don't jump from position to position. I'm not a lifetime politician. I can honestly tell the people of the state of Florida, I have no desire to be president. I have no desire, to do anything else besides govern our state. This is it. I'm not looking to, okay, if I don't win this time, I'll run next time. No, I am passionate about this job, this time frame, this position, because we are in a crisis in our country and in our state. And so people of our state need to decide, what side of history are you going to be on? Are you going to continue to fight for democracy and the things that we hold true in our state and create history, not only fight for history, create history with the first female governor of our state? And so when I have no doubt that when the Democrats have to make that choice in the ballot box, they will know that we need to try something new and that we need to have a true winner and fighter in our court. This is going to be a fight that we have never had before in this race. There's going to be more money flowing into the state of Florida than we have ever seen before, more attention on this race than we've ever seen before. And so we need somebody who is battle tested, who is able to take on Ron DeSantis. I make him squirm. He is prone to making mistakes, and I am prone to capitalizing on the mistakes that he makes. So that's why I'm the best suited to be that Democratic nominee and to fight head on with Ron DeSantis.
Nikki Fried is our guest. Again, she's running for governor here in the state of Florida. Find her website at NikkiFried.com, spelled fried, really, F-R-I-E-D. And on Twitter, same way, at Nikki Fried. All right, so Ron DeSantis, Florida's been a mess for a while, but he's made it a ridiculous mess. And there's nothing funny about it. COVID is raging here, even though people are denying it. Not only does he refuse any kind of mask mandates or vaccine mandates or to ask for a vaccine passport, but he ruled unilaterally, I guess, that no school board or any other entity in the state could initiate a mask mandate. Well, many school districts did. You mentioned you represent Broward County. I live in Broward County. I went to Broward County public schools from middle school on up. Where did you grow up?
I went to
Hollywood Hills High School and Olson Middle School. We moved from New York. I went to Olson Middle School. So Broward County and Alachua County, you mentioned up in Gainesville area, were the first two to say, hold on, our kids are at risk here. We are going to institute a mask mandate. To make a long story short, DeSantis decided he said he's going to fine the school board members $5,000 each if they institute this. Now he's saying he's going to fine individuals. What is he doing? Individuals who allow this to happen? $5,000 or each $5,000 for each employee who gets vaccinated or some nonsense. What is he doing now? You know better than I do.
Yeah, so what happened is that he came up with this rule and that he had an executive order that said that, yes, school districts could not have a mask requirement, mask mandate. And so we saw what happened. And, you know, I was a part of that big fight because I saw what was going on and told our school boards that I was going to get their back. And that's what we did. We called the White House and called the administration and said, this is what is happening in the state of Florida. We need help. And you saw almost days after my call to the White House that both President Biden and his press secretary came out in very strong support and said, look, if we are not going to let that happen. And so has in fact created a grant program for each school district and school board members to apply that if in fact he withholds money, which is now what he's threatening, to withhold their funds that equivalent to their salaries. So it's bad enough that he creates an executive order that he didn't have the power to create to begin with.
Right.
Ben has now gone out of his way to use taxpayer dollars to litigate this issue and continue to litigate this issue, but it's also now going to be withholding money. And so thank you, President Biden, for stepping up and helping us. What he now has taken is the next step is that we have, they passed a law this past session that says that no employer and no company can ask for, you know, they're calling it a COVID passport.
Right.
I don't want to give in to what they're saying. So it's, you know, requiring the people to show that they have been vaccinated.
Right.
And so they are not allowed to do that, which again is crazy. We're in the middle of a healthcare crisis. And most importantly, whatever happened to free market? I was talking to a gentleman earlier today who owns barbecue restaurants all across the state of Florida. And I said to him, I said, look, if you so choose to want to make, you know, having vaccines for your patrons and know that you're going to lose 10 or 15% of your business to the Sunnies down the road, that's a business decision that is on you to make. It's not the government's decision. It should be you as a business owner. But now what he's done, and so that law did not touch employees. But now he's saying, wait a sec. And he actually has a press conference back in the day when this bill was passed that said it did not impact employees. And that was a personal decision, and government shouldn't be involved in that. And now he's coming out and saying for every government agency, both as a school district, hospitals, law enforcement, first responders, and then local governments, puts in any requirement that their employees get vaccinated, each incident,
$5,000.
$5,000 fine.
We're living crazy down there. It's just unbelievable. It is stunning to me. And I walk around and I hear people regurgitating lies, stuff that's just simply not true. And they're getting it from this man. Nikki Fried, now I heard you're not in favor of mask mandates, are you?
So what I am in favor of is, you know, first of all, I called for mask mandate last year. I was very in front of the issue and said that that was really important. And I continue to say that we have to be masking. We have to follow the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines, it's very clear. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you are indoors, you should be masking.
That's
up.
Right.
So I have said very clearly that we need to be following the CDC guidelines, which would be masking up everywhere inside, including in our schools. But I've also said that I believe in our local electeds, both on our city and county commissioners and our school boards, to be doing what is right for their communities and given the power to do that. Because look, at the end of the day, it was our county and city commissioners last year that all stepped up to the plate and got us through this pandemic. It was our business community and our local electeds, not the governor. The
right.
Governor ran ahead. He hid behind everything and did, it was like, oh, I don't know what to do here. And allowed our locals to do it, and they did, and they stepped up, and it was seamless. This time around, he wants all the power and doesn't want our local governments to do it. So I have been trying to empower our local governments. They're the ones who are closest to the people, and that's where government should be, is closest to the people. They know their communities the best, and that's really where any kinds of requirements should be. But I've been very staunch on saying we need to be following the CDC guidelines, which is masking
good.
Up.
Okay, good to know. We've only got a few minutes left, and I have a million more questions for you, so maybe we can get together again. But I want to ask about redistricting, because that's coming up. And back 10 years ago, here in Florida, we passed a constitutional amendment, Fair Districts Florida, to have the congressional districts, all districts, drawn by an independent, nonpartisan committee. And that hasn't happened. It's all still very partisan. And here we go again. They're getting ready to redraw the districts, despite the fact that there are more registered Democrats in the state of Florida. Republicans control the legislature. What's going to happen here and what should happen?
I'm very nervous. I'm very nervous. I've talked to our leadership in the House and the Senate. I've talked to our party leadership. I've talked to grassroots organizations, to labor organizations. This is going to be an all-on assault gerrymandering at its worst. And so what we have also seen is that there's also no transparency. They're not having hearings. Even 10 years ago, they went around the state and still had workshops and still had hearings. They have no intention of doing that this time around. And so I have said very clearly to all of my contemporaries in the Democratic Party and activists and grassroots organizations that we need to be getting that message out now. The message is very clear. This is going to be a partisan-driven process, and it's not going to be transparent, and they are going to gerrymander these districts against the Constitution. And unfortunately, we don't have the courts. The courts are not going to fare in a fair way, unfortunately, and the Supreme Court is more likely than not going to back up the maps that are coming out of the legislature. So this is something that we, the people, need to be talking about, getting in front of, be messaging with our elected officials on the Senate and the House, and tell them that this is not okay. And even if, this is what I keep saying too, even if the worst case outcome happens and they gerrymander these districts, we have got to vote like we have never voted before. And the NPAs that are out there are going to be the ones who have to help us hold them accountable and elect them out of office. But we're going to need everybody to understand.
NPA is no party affiliation.
Yes. Right. Yes.
Independence. Yes. Just making sure everyone knows what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes. And that we are going to need our non-party voters out there to stand up and say enough is enough. Enough of not following the Constitution. Enough of not following the statutes. Enough of creating a state that is only there to help the top 1%ers and the people that are staying in power. And they've got to stand up. And there's a reason why that they are NPAs, because they are tired of all of this.
Right.
And they don't want to pick a party. So it's time to send the party that has been in office for 25 straight years packing, because they are not following the rules anymore.
Well, let me tell you something from a registered Democrat who is, because the alternative is so much worse. But the Democratic Party here in Florida is ineffective at best. And I'm being really generous here. I have a foul potty mouth, but I'm respecting who I have on with me, and I'm not going there. But I actually ran. I became a precinct committee person to help a progressive influx of voices into the Florida Democratic Party. The Florida Democratic Party has done everything they can to diss the progressive wing. They elected Manny Diaz as chair of the Democratic Party of Florida, who is the last person who should have a role in certainly Democratic Party politics, but any politics. I'm so disgusted with the party. It is dysfunctional on its best day and horrific on its worst. In fact, Manny Diaz took it upon himself to put out a press release excoriating the progressive caucus inside the Florida Democratic Party rather than dealing with moving forward. So that's my, I'm hoping if you get in there, you will somehow take control of the Democratic Party and whip it into shape, because that's another, I'm sorry, it's not working well for you, for any of us right now.
Yeah, and there is huge problems. And I think that part of the problem is this. We haven't had, you know, and I came in and I have been very honest too about this. I've been a Democrat my entire life, but I haven't been involved in the Democratic Party. So when I first came into office, I didn't know a lot of the party leaders. I didn't know the chairs of each of the counties and the clubs. And so I spent a lot of time the last 2.5 years getting ingratiated with everybody, learning who everybody is, what is the background of some of the party stuff. And so it has been really important for me to get that ground, because you're right that there is such dysfunction within the party. And so I spent a lot of time on the phones, especially after November of 2020, listening and talking and giving them advice and suggestions about how to organize, how to fundraise, how to make sure that we are not going to the voters just before an election. That's not a winning combination. We got to be constantly, you know, going to the communities, going and talking to them and doing what I'm calling value added. You know, go, if it's Broward County, Broward should be doing beach cleanups every other weekend. Mm-hmm. They should be building Habitat for Humanities. If you're on the West Coast, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. How are we as Democrats showing the people of our state that we care more about them and the communities than we care about winning an election? And so the only way that we're going to win is to make people truly understand that we as a party care about their lives, care about making sure that there's food on their plates, that there's home, that there's roofs over their heads, that they've got, you know, good paying jobs, and showing that support on the local level consistently. So what I have said, it's all about the message. It's having a consistent message, consistently messaging, and trusted messengers. And until the Democratic Party can figure out how to get that right, and I certainly hope that I am the conduit to make that happen in November of 2022, I've got not to be on air kind of conversation, but certainly I've got a game plan of how we're going to win in November and how to make sure that we are building our bench and how we are organizing like we have never organized in the state. And it's going to take a leader that truly understands all of that to bring everybody together and start turning the page of this and bringing our party together. There shouldn't be internal fighting within the party. And unfortunately, that happens. And so we need a trusted leader to bring everybody together. And so, you know, given that we'll be the nominee in August and then win in November, then we'll be able to truly create a party that is sustainable and aren't turning over new leaders every 2 years, which is what has happened, and not have an internal structure in place.
All right. And there we go. Nikki Fried, again, the other candidate running for governor
of Florida, well, running for the Democratic nomination to take on Ron DeSantis in November. Our primary here in Florida is coming up on the 23rd of August. Early voting starts in a couple of weeks. Vote-by-mail ballots have started going out. We haven't gotten ours yet, but they have gone out, or I understand they're in the process of. So that's the story here. That interview was recorded back in September as well, both of them. That one, September 20th. Of 2021. There was some breaking news while those interviews were running, and take it with a grain of salt, the same grain of salt you use whenever you hear anything about Joe Manchin. Here's the headline. Manchin and Schumer announced slimmed down $670 billion deal. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and centrist Joe Manchin on Wednesday said they agreed to the $670 billion deal on Democratic priorities weeks after Manchin seemingly had scuttled any chance of an agreement with hesitancy over inflation. All right, well, this is the wrong one because this doesn't say what it includes. Here it goes. Okay, let's see. On reducing health care costs, addressing climate change, and lowering the deficit? Seriously? So is that prescribed? I don't know. I'm going to have to read this, and I'll let you know tomorrow. I'll have it in What's News, and we'll deal with it on the show tomorrow. We'll also talk with Annette Tadeo. And, you know, it's a Thursday. All right? I will leave you with the news, because we can, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for being here, everyone. Do share those interviews. Today's show will be posted in just a few minutes at NicoleSandler.com/7-27-22, today's date. But it is primary season, so hopefully Floridians can get an idea from that of who they want to vote for. All right, until tomorrow, keep the faith, baby, or not, however your, you know, beliefs lie. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Attorney General Merrick Garland is finally speaking about the DOJ's investigation into the attempted overturning of our last presidential election by the former guy and his flunkies. In an interview with NBC's Lester Holt on Tuesday, the attorney general made a few things clear.
We will hold accountable anyone who was criminally responsible for attempting to interfere with the transfer, legitimate, lawful transfer of power from one administration to the next.
Garland said the Justice Department is also investigating efforts by Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election and use the Justice Department to push baseless claims of voter fraud. That's pretty big, but there's more, lots more news in the last day or so. The first round of House Select Committee hearings may be in the rearview mirror, but news from the committee keeps coming. On Tuesday, the House Select Committee released a video of the testimony of former Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller. He disputed the former guy's claim that he requested up to 20,000 National Guard troops because he had a feeling, quote, the crowd was going to be very large when lawmakers met to certify the results of the election. So, as to Trump's claim,
not from my perspective, I was never given any direction or order or knew of any plans of that nature. So I was surprised by seeing that publicly.
To be crystal clear, there was no direct order from President Trump to put 10,000 troops to be on the ready for January 6th.
That's correct. There was no order from the president.
Another huge scoop, this one from the New York Times, reporting on previously undisclosed emails from the weeks leading up to the insurrection on January 6th, in which advisors openly referred to those slates of alternative electors that they got supporters to produce as fake. They used the word. Here's a quote from Arizona lawyer Jack Willinchek on December 8th, 2020, in writing to Trump advisor Boris Epstein. Quote, we would just be sending in fake electoral votes to Pence so that someone in Congress can make an objection when they start counting votes and can start arguing that the fake votes should be counted. That same lawyer later suggested that, quote, alternative votes is probably a better term than fake votes. And he punctuated that line with a smiley face. Alrighty then. Oh, This lawyer, Willinchek, also said that he and Arizona Republican Party Chair Kelly Ward, Trump's pick for governor of Arizona, had discussed keeping the plan quiet so that, quote, we can try to surprise the Dems and the media with it. Noted Republican lawyer and never Trumper George Conway tweeted, quote, if you had asked me to hypothesize for illustrative purposes a set of emails that prosecutors would find helpful in proving a fake elector fraud conspiracy, I would not have come up with anything nearly as incriminating as the emails that the Times just reported on today. So there's that. And then the Washington Post reported that the Department of Justice is investigating the former president as part of its criminal investigation of efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The DOJ already charged more than 850 people in the events surrounding Trump's attempts to remain in power, and they say there are two possible avenues of criminal prosecution. One is that Trump participated in the attempt to delay or obstruct an official proceeding, which is the crime for which other participants in the events of January 6th have been indicted. The other is the fraud of setting up the fake electors from the states. Stay tuned. It's another busy day in Congress where the Senate today will hold a vote on the final passage of the $280 billion CHIPS Plus bill. 64 senators voted for cloture on Tuesday, so we know that the legislation will pass. It's considered a major victory for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who's been pushing for this bill for nearly 18 months. Also, last week, all but 8 House Republicans voted against the Democrats' bill, affirming our access to contraception. And today, well, it's the Senate's turn. Senate Republicans today are expected to block a bill that basically states that as Americans, we have access to birth control. Now, there are some Senate Republicans, Joni Ernst and a few others, who are introducing a Republican version of this access to contraception bill by expanding access to birth control over the counter. But this bill excludes emergency contraception not already accessible over the counter and any medication that the FDA has approved for inducing abortion. But this proposal isn't expected to gain any traction. However, it is an attempt to show that some Republicans support contraception access. And finally, a new generic congressional ballot shows Democrats with a 4-point advantage over Republicans, but the numbers still aren't great. It's 45% to 41%. We got a lot of work to do. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.